Once again, Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach, everyone. I wish you were as lucky as I am to be able to walk through the congregation and feel so close to so many people. I tell you, you don't know what nachas I get from actually saying good Shabbos and good Yontif to people that I know about, that I know and care about. I wish everybody knew each other the way I have come to know so many of you, and you would have that same experience. I think it's the greatest experience of the whole Yontif, is being able to really greet people, know what their life is all about, know that they care about your life, and when you wish them a good year, you really mean it. You know what they've been through, you know where the pains were, you know where the losses were, you know what their hopes and their dreams are. It's an incredible feeling. Maybe it's the greatest feeling that a rabbi has, is to look out to a congregation and realize how many people's lives he or she has been a part of. So I wish somehow that I could spread that joy that I have inside of me when I see you to all of you. A bit of an apology. You didn't hear the shofar today. It's not because David Volansky's lost his wind. It's not because we forgot the calling. I'd like to say it's because every once in a while, every few years, we want to remind everybody that there's a second day Rosh Hashanah. So if you're going to hear the shofar, you have to come tomorrow. But the real reason is that after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, our people entered a period of mourning, and there became a restriction against musical instruments that were connected to the worship in the Beit HaMikdash, first in Shiloh and then in Jerusalem. And while we have gotten to the point, especially after the creation of the State of Israel and the reunification of Jerusalem, where most congregations, certainly in the conservative movement, the Reconstructionists, the Reform movement, the Renewal movements, have reinstituted music in Shabbat and festival services, we demonstrate the respect for Shabbat by not blowing the shofar today. I hope that perhaps the cantor's voice, some of my remarks, might convey to you a message of the shofar, even without hearing those sounds. And that is that we need to awaken to what our lives are really all about. That Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are the 3 days we set aside to begin to think about who we are, what we are, what it is that we have done with our lives so far, and to celebrate the fact that our lives are not over, and we have an opportunity to be and to accomplish the things that are truly important to us. And that's true for each and every person. Whether you're sick or well, whether you're rich or poor, whether you had all your money invested with Bernie Madoff, or you had it in Washington Mutual Bank, which might not have been such a great idea either, the reality is we're all here today. And we have the opportunity to make our lives the way we want it to be. So I want to put in a special request that you come tomorrow and express my gratitude to God for making the second day Rosh Hashanah this year a Sunday so that nobody has an excuse. I say that because I'm as aware as you are that the second day is boring to most people. The first day is boring to a good number. To do it again, the same prayers with the same melodies, if the sermon didn't change, it would be an instant replay. And I realize why fewer people come on the second day than the first. But this year is an opportunity for it to be different. We're going to have on the Bima not just our Chazan, and not just a young baritone, a graduate of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, whom you're going to hear participating with the Chazan today, but also a dynamic and wonderful soprano who has mesmerized audiences throughout San Francisco with her renditions of Yiddish and English and Hebrew and Israeli songs. And I'm going to take the liberty, I hope the traditionalists within our congregation won't be too angry, but I'm going to take the liberty to make tomorrow different from today. Significantly different. The Torah reading is going to be different, and the prayers are going to be different. In the prayers, we're going to infuse the Musaf service with contemporary Jewish music, Yiddish lullabies, music that's been written for the Broadway stage with a Jewish theme. And we're going to make those our Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofrot, the three major portions of Musaf. After the Torah reading, before the Musaf, in lieu of a regular sermon, I'm going to take a chance. I hope it goes well. I have no way of knowing. But what I want to do is reenact the Torah reading as a form of psychodrama. I was blessed to attend a workshop by a great Jewish psychiatrist who developed a principle of psychodrama to better understand the narratives in the Torah reading. And I promise you, there is no story in the Torah more poignant and more appropriate for a psychodrama than the Torah reading of tomorrow, where Abraham is commanded by God to slay the son that he was given in today's Torah portion. And only when his hand is above Isaac, only when it's raised to slaughter his own son, is his hand stayed and the ram takes its place. What went through Abraham's mind? What was the feeling of this man, 100 years old, who just celebrated his son being weaned from his mother's breast, to be able to raise a knife above that son, bound on an altar? What was going on in the minds of Sarah when she heard that early in the morning, Abraham left and took Isaac to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah? And what was going on in the mind of that little boy who couldn't move, bound on that altar, laying on top of sticks with a firebrand next to it, and seeing the man whom he thought was God, his father, about to kill him? So, if you've been stirred by this story and wondering what indeed was in the minds of those people, I hope you're with us tomorrow, as here on the Bema we turn it into sacred theater, to a stage, and begin to explore what went through the mind and the hearts of the people in tomorrow's Torah reading. Now for today. When we sat in our Thursday morning Torah study minyan, we departed from our study of the Chumash, of the regular text, to do a little Talmud study. We did so because we were trying to find out what Rosh Hashanah is all about. You see, in the Torah, we are told virtually nothing of this holiday. It's not even called Rosh Hashanah. It's not called the New Year. As a matter of fact, it specifically states that it's not the New Year, that it takes place not on the first month, but the seventh month. And all we're told is Zichron Teruah, some sort of a memorial in hearing the blast of a horn. And in ancient times, that horn was not a shofar, but a trumpet. And we're told virtually nothing else. It's nearly a millennium later that the sages of the Talmud begin to search for meaning of this special day. They first say that there are four Rosh Hashanahs during the year. This is one of four and not even the first. This is the Rosh Hashanah in which we determine when the year begins for tithing. This is the year in which the Rosh Hashanah in which we begin leaving the land lay fallow. And when the 50 years there's a jubilee, this is the day when that year begins. It doesn't sound at all like Jews coming to shul in their finest clothing and sitting for hours through a period of self-examination to determine what their lives are all about. But as we go through the Talmud, we find one sage, Rabbi Eliezer, who, on his own, makes a statement about the meaning of this day. He says, on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Tishrei, a number of events occurred. One was that the world was created this day. Another was that three women of the Bible received a positive response to their utmost and most heartfelt plea. And on this day, Joseph was released from prison. From his first statement, developed the tradition that Rosh Hashanah is the birthday of the world. And that becomes a theme in the Musaf service, disregarding the fact that it's the seventh month and not the first month. But the other two aspects are not discussed in any detail whatsoever. That Sarah, Rachel, and Hannah had their encounter with God as a response to their plea to have a child. And certainly nothing is ever mentioned about the fact that this day is the day that Joseph was released from the Egyptian prison. Of course, as the centuries went on, Rosh Hashanah became a more elaborate festival. It became connected with Yom Kippur, the first of 10 days leading up to that Yom Kippur, and it developed the entire aura of not merely self-reflection, but a search for forgiveness, examination of our deeds, and the prayers to Shuvah, Tefillah, Tzedakah, to commit ourselves to repentance, to prayer, sincere prayer, and acts of tzedakah, of righteousness. But this year I was fascinated with the saying of Rabbi Elazar. What was he really talking about? Today the world was born. Today Sarah and Rachel and Hannah had their prayers answered. Today, Joseph was released from prison. What was he talking about? You see, one thing I know for sure is that Rabbi Eliezer had no idea when the world was created. Nobody does. No one. No one was there. Not us. Not even animals or birds or fish. Not even insects. Not even plants. According to the Torah, the first thing is light. So who would know when the world was created? Secondly, did Rabbi Eliezer know that this is the day that Sarah, Rachel, and Hannah got their prayers answered? Absolutely not. He wasn't there either. Not in the early biblical times or even later biblical times. He wasn't there when we told the story of Sarah. He wasn't there when the story of Rachel occurred. He wasn't there with the story of the Haftarah. He lived centuries later. So what was he talking about? And identifying this day as the day that Joseph is released from prison? Where did you know that from? Was he in Egypt at the time? Spaziering around Cairo, going to the bazaar? Absolutely not. So what was Rabbi Elazar actually saying? And this is the Moshe Levin theory. I want to share with you today what I believe might have been behind his identification of this day with those events. I think that Rabbi Elazar was trying to say that on this day we have to focus on three of the most significant aspects of life. Creation, encounter with God, and redemption. Creation is the symbol of life and the world in perfection. When the Torah tells us the story of creation, everything is exactly as it should be. There is nothing wrong. Everything is right. Even with the Garden of Eden story, there is no eating of one animal of another. Plants and trees and bushes and grass grow, and Adam and Eve pick their fruit from the trees. Life is perfect. Nobody has to work. Nobody has to sweat and toil. Creation is the image of the world in perfection. But the world is not perfect. Not at all. We're expelled from the Garden of Eden out into the real world. And it's a world that's filled with sorrows, with problems, with challenges, with suffering, with tragedies. Not such a perfect world after all. So Rabbi Elazar says, we need to connect the creation of the world with women who turn to God for what they believe is essential. We have to focus on the fact that women in this world have a sense of what is really needed to fix it, not men. Rabbi Elazar did not say this is the day in which Abraham encountered God, that he had a plea, or that Moses did, or King David did. They're all biblical figures, great biblical figures. And Rabbi Elazar does not mention them at all. Their encounter with God, as magnificent as it appears in the Torah, doesn't even occupy a moment of his attention. His attention is on the women in the Bible. They know what to ask for, he says. And because they knew what to ask for, and they reached that which we call divine, we celebrate that and connect it to this day, the day when we imagine the world to be perfect. And what's the proof that women understand the real needs of the world? That the world starts to be getting better when they're responded to. That is the symbol of Joseph being released from prison. That's the first redemption from slavery. Joseph, this innocent young man, is thrown into a dungeon to languish his whole life. But by divine intervention, Joseph, from a dream, emerges from prison and rises to become viceroy of Egypt. What made it happen? I think Rabbi Elazar says it is women. This is the holiday to celebrate the fact that women know how to fix the world. Let me relate that to the world in which we live. There are big problems. Big problems. There's continuing genocide in Darfur. Despite the fact that all Western countries, the United Nations, all were ready to put a stranglehold on Sudan, they've accomplished nothing to stop an incredible genocide. We don't even notice what's going on in the Congo. We hold and cherish the number 6 million as an incredible, unfathomable loss of human life. Do you know that 5.5 million people in the Congo have already been killed by rebel forces and government forces already just in the past few years? We live in a world that saw a Bosnia and a Serbia breakaways from Yugoslavia turn to kill each other. We live in a world in which in East Africa there is poverty greater than we can imagine. And people live in the sub-Sahara have virtually nothing to eat. There's incredible famine and drought. We live in a world that in the southern portion of Africa, AIDS runs rampant. And the governments, the male-dominated governments, refuse to do what is so easy to do to stem the tide of that horrible disease. We live in a world in which a few people on Wall Street or not on Wall Street were able to reverse prosperity in the entire globe. We live in a world in which the banker down the street on 19th Avenue and certainly those in headquarters in New York had such greed that it resulted in people now a nearly 12% rate of unemployment in this country. The world has serious, terrible problems. And I know you think it's a stretch, but I think that Rabbi Lazar saw something incredibly significant. That if we want to have an image of the world in perfection, if we want to see a liberation from the dungeon, it takes women, not men. Women, not men. What motivates me to think in these terms is the fact that in every country where there is dire poverty, women are abused. They have virtually little or no rights. They are beaten by husbands with the order and permission of clerics. They are thrown into graves with husbands when the husband dies. They have their throats slit when there's a suspicion of any sexual impropriety. And in all of the countries in which women are abused, there is poverty. We have a feeling of despair about the world in which we live in. We're grateful to be in the United States because we don't know what to do about those problems in Africa. We don't know what to do about those problems with AIDS. We don't know what to do about those problems of poverty and drought and so on. We don't know what to do about it. But here and there are little changes being made that shows that women can bring redemption to this world. You heard about that young man who went to the Far East. And in Pakistan, where he was going mountain climbing, he ended up noticing that girls were not getting an education in all those villages. And wrote to friends and got some money and started building schools just for girls. He is changing the world by giving an education to young women. You've heard of those funds that lend money to women to start their own little businesses. $65 is what they start with. One magnificent story is that of a woman who was beaten by her husband because he felt he was ready to take a younger wife and he wanted her to run away. She got a loan. And with that, she started sewing and making garments and things that other people in the village could buy. And after a while, she had enough to employ other women in the village. And soon she was supporting half the village and her husband, who stopped looking for another wife. There are stories replete like this around the globe. Because what studies show is that in impoverished countries, when men get money, they buy alcohol and women. When women get money, they use it for education, for health, and for food. For education, for health, and for food. I don't know what would have happened if Hillary Clinton would have become president. There are some women who are men. Golda Meir was one example. As proud as we were that Israel had a prime minister who was a woman, I think it was Ben-Gurion who said she was the best man he ever had in his cabinet. I'm not making the suggestion that every woman on the earth is motivated with that same commitment to seeing life develop, to reaching for that moment of creation, that state of perfection of the world, to freeing the Josephs from the dungeons. There are women who are selfish and there are women who are evil. And there are men who are good and kind and filled with compassion. But I'm coming to believe that the majority is the reverse. That, like what Rabbi Leza saw, is that women have a sense of deep understanding of what priorities are and what should be good. And that men go out to fight wars and battles, are excited by violence, are unconcerned about human rights. And that women as a class, as a category, have compassion and sensitivity that, generally speaking, the male of our species lacks. That's why when Jewish tradition refers to God in terms of mercy and compassion, feminine images are used. Do you notice that? God is a symbol of justice as Adonai, master, melech, king. God of a source of compassion and mercy is the Shekhinah, Malei Rachamim. Malei Rachamim means God is filled with a womb. Rachamim Rachmanes doesn't mean mercy, it means womb. The Shekhinah is the feminine noun for the presence of God. And it's that term that's invoked when we speak of God of compassion. The Midrash says that when the shofar is sounded, God stands up from the throne of judgment and moves over to the throne of mercy. What the Midrash is saying is that if we look at our lives, and especially if we look at the world, one wonders, do we really have a right to go on? Do we deserve life? But when God shows mercy, we're given the benefit of the doubt. We're given another chance to make the world into its state of perfection. My friends, I think Rosh Hashanah is a woman's holiday. I remember when the conservative movement was afraid to see women become rabbis, cantors, or synagogue presidents. I remember those discussions because I graduated rabbinical school right at that critical time. And I remember those older rabbis, they were younger than I am now, but then they appeared like older rabbis. I remember them saying that if we admit women to the minyan, men will stop coming to shul. Women should be held back because men won't stand their ground. Well, it took a few votes, but they lost. And now we see women taking the most important places in all aspects of Jewish life. And Ner Tamid is no example. I hope and pray that we begin to see more efforts by women and supported by all of us. Because, my friends, the way the world is spiraling, I think it's only women that will bring us out of prison and bring liberation to a world that so desperately needs it. As we begin this new year, my kippah goes out to all of those women who do more than make a kugel and a brisket on Rosh Hashanah, but instead give us the dream that the world can indeed be magnificent. Good Yantif and good Yor.